You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko skapres tōku noa, ko te tākaumārua kāraka, ki te whakaronga koe ki te Wire. Good afternoon and welcome to The Wire for Tuesday, Ratu, the 10th of December. For December, my name is Oscar Perez and I'll be your host for today. Sorry, we're just working out some mic stuff, as per. Today I'm joined in studio by Sam. How are you on this rather bluish day?
Yeah, it's good to be here, Oscar. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, well, thank you for coming on. Today we are bringing you, the listener, a full day of news, etc. and information. What are we bringing you, you may ask? That is quite a good question. We've got a few pieces. Sam, what have you got for us today?
So today I spoke with Jenny Cartwright from Child Poverty Action Group about the Child Poverty Data Monitor and the organisation's recommendations to the government.
Oh, amazing. So then after that, we've got the regular piece that is Green Desk coming to you. Revisiting a story from earlier in the year with a few added details. So it's another wonderful piece by Mitchell, as per usual. And then following that, we kind of close the show with a little piece about early childhood education. Remember, if you can, well, if you missed the show for some reason but are listening now, you can catch all these stories in full by podcast on the 95BFM website. And if you want to share your thoughts with us, you can text us on 5395. Or why am I, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. You can also find us across all the social medias, that's at 95BFM News, across all Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So Sam, do you have a bit more detail about your piece before we dive right into it?
Yeah, so basically Child Poverty Action Group have made, alongside the Welfare Expert Advisory Group, made a series of recommendations to government based on bringing down the levels of children living in poverty in Aotearoa, New Zealand, over the next few years, so prospectively like another Labour term. Currently, there are about 144,000 children that are living in poverty in New Zealand, and that's a statistic which neither the government nor the groups that it had, the commissions that it's had into these levels, find acceptable. So, yeah.
Amazing. Here is that piece now.
What are the changes that Child Poverty Action Group recommends that the government undertake if it wishes to reduce child poverty?
Well, we're saying that there are a few key things that they could do very quickly and very simply that will mean families who are struggling the most have immediately more money in their pockets to be able to afford food, to be able to afford to pay bills, all of the basic essentials that they are currently falling behind on. And one of those changes is that the discrimination should be removed from a portion of the Working for Families tax credit package, which is called the InWork tax credit. So currently, that amount of money, so it's $72.50 a week for eligible families, but you can only get that payment if you're off the benefit entirely, and if you're a sole parent, if you work 20 hours a week or more in paid employment, and if you are in a couple, you have to work 30 hours or more between you in paid work. So on the one hand, that particular payment doesn't recognise the value of caregiving as a job, but it also, and it discriminates against sole parents, because sole parents who are, you know, doing things tougher, you know, parenting on your own is not an easy job, and you know, there's a lot more juggling that has to come into that. So they're expected to work more hours per week per person, per adult, than a couple, and they have to be off the benefit entirely to get that money. So the idea behind it is that it's a work incentive and that it pays for the additional cost of working. But we also know that when people are in casualised jobs, you know, they can't necessarily work that number of hours for whatever reason, that it doesn't necessarily incentivise working more. So, you know, it's really just the idea behind it is that it targets child poverty, so it's supposed to reduce child poverty. And currently what it actually does is it allows some families to have a little bit more money, and it also allows them to weigh up whether one parent in part-time work or one parent staying at home with the children is more beneficial to the family. So what we're saying is that in the short, it hasn't proven successful as a work incentive. It's a payment that's supposed to reduce child poverty. It's not reaching the children who are in the worst of poverty, and it should go to them. So we're saying that the work hours test should be removed. The paid work hours test should value all contributions, including parenting, as its work. And immediately, if that was given to every family who are on a welfare benefit currently, it would make them at least $72 better off every week.
What has the response been from the government to the series of recommendations that have been made to them?
Well, so far we are hearing that they are working on a 3 to 5 year plan for enacting on the recommendations of the Welfare Expert Advisory Group, but we haven't heard any immediate plans to address those particular recommendations. And one of those recommendations for us too, that we see as being vitally important, is to significantly increase benefits. But by doing the suggestion of increasing or allowing all families on benefits to have that and work tax credit, they're actually increasing welfare benefits, thereby making that payment very targeted to helping those most in need.
Has the government been hesitant to implement any new initiatives? Have they been wholly responsive, or have there been some things that they've been less willing to do than others?
Clearly in the last budget there weren't any specific increases to benefits, which we had hoped for. We also had hoped for this policy to be enacted, but we aren't hearing what they're planning to do next. So we are waiting for this 3 to 5 year plan to be released so that we actually know what they are planning in the short term and what they are planning in the long term. But what is, you know, what's vitally clear to us is that benefit incomes are inadequate. They need to be raised significantly. So what we have seen, I suppose, just to talk a little bit about that, was the Welfare Expert Advisory Group was established in 2018. They produced their report, so that was an establishment by the government. So they produced a report with 42 recommendations and 120 comprehensive recommendations in the early part of this year. And in response to that, the government has promised it will index benefits to average wage inflation from next year, and it will also index the threshold for paid earnings to the minimum wage increases as well. And the other promise is that they will put 263 more frontline staff in to help those in need at work and income offices, for example. Mm-hmm. So those are all really valuable initiatives, but what we've said is that benefits should have been indexed to wages for the entire time that we have had them. For them to suddenly be indexed to wages without being restored to the levels that they should have been at if they had been indexed properly, A, and B, if they hadn't have been subjected to all those cuts in 1991, then that indexation will only mean small increases year on year in the future. So we actually really, really need benefits to be restored to a level that provides an adequate living standard to everybody who has need of one, to every family, to every individual who has need of one right now. And then the indexation should come into that, and that will mean that they will be keeping up over time, and that will mean hopefully that families don't fall behind again. And what we're also asking for is that they do changes around housing. We need many more affordable housing options. We need a lot more state houses. We need perhaps eligibility for state housing to change so that more people can be eligible for them. And we just need that pressure to be taken off families so that they can actually thrive, so that they can go about their weeks without this huge stress that is causing all sorts of other adverse impacts on their health, on their mental health, and preventing them from being able to move forward and to meet all their children's needs.
For Child Poverty Action Group, what do you see as the key drivers of child poverty in New Zealand?
Well, it's a lack of incomes, really. It's a huge pressure of housing costs. So as the Child Poverty Monitor yesterday reported, 30% of the families of households on the lowest incomes, and these are households with children in New Zealand, are spending more than half their incomes on their housing, which means they're not left with enough for everything else, and they are the families that have to go to food bank charities regularly because they're not able to afford enough healthy food. They need temporary additional supplements from work and income so that they can continue to get by. They often need emergency grants for their housing needs. So clearly the drivers of poverty are lack of incomes, they're unaffordable housing, there's not enough housing, but also, you know, there are other pressures, there are the rising cost of living that contribute to that. But if we had more opportunities, I suppose, for people to transition into the workforce, and to be able to do that without huge complexities and huge additional stresses, then, you know, more meaningful work opportunities. But we have a lack for all of those things, and we really, really need families who are in need to be adequately supported financially, because that is the key driver. And really, you have to look historically at the changes to the welfare system and the changes in housing to actually pinpoint where some of the things have gone wrong for families, so that they have, you know, become trapped in this deep poverty. They've acquired debt, which further impacts on their ability to make their ends meet, and they're just sort of stuck in this place where it's really, really hard to get out of poverty. So, you know, looking historically at those changes in the welfare system, those cuts in 1991, sell-off of state housing, property speculation as a booming industry, you have to really look to those things to see that there have been there's a cohort of people who have never been able to get ahead after those changes, and we owe them a lot, I think.
You talked about housing and the environment, and do you believe that for a child that grows up in an environment where housing and resources are inadequate, that this can have a lifelong impact on that person's well-being?
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, if a child grows up in a housing situation where it's cold and damp, if they're constantly in transitional housing or emergency housing, they may be living in motels on and off, so they lack the stability and security, and their health is impacted by those, you know, from potentially living in unhealthy housing. Where they live in situations where, you know, we're seeing that more and more families are having to live together just to be able to afford to live in private rentals. And when they are having to do so, the other circumstances that can occur are infection spreading throughout the household more rapidly. You know, a cold spreads and goes round continuously. They just may never have that stability in their lives. We're hearing that some young adults who are struggling these days to find housing, some young adults have never had stable housing in their lives, and that has a huge impact on them, you know, when they're starting their adult lives. And if they've had health impacts because of unhealthy housing over that time too, some of those things can stay with them their lifelong. Also, there's the impact on their education. If a child moves from house to house, they may not be able to attend school regularly. If they're in transitional housing, or if there's not enough money for food, then they may not be able to get the most out of their education. And, you know, there are all sorts of additional factors that can have really lifelong implications for children. So it's vitally important, A, that they have enough money for healthy food so that they're able to have all of their needs met, so that they have their clothes, the warm clothes in winter time, so that they're able to go to school regularly and to be able to learn effectively because they're well nourished, but also that they are in a stable, secure home environment that, you know, continuously throughout their childhood, so that they, you know, they have that sense of security, so that they don't have time out of school, and so that they have that stability in their lives.
I just want to ask quickly, who are we talking about when we discuss families living in poverty? What does a family living in poverty look like in modern day Aotearoa?
Well, I guess
we can say for certain that there are, from the government statistics, that there are 174,000 children living in households who have income that is underneath the very lowest supplementary measure of the Child Poverty Reduction Act, which is 40% of the national equivalised median after housing costs. And we can say for sure that many of those children, if not all of them, will be living on households that are supported by a welfare benefit. We know that there are a lot of children living in sole parent families accessing a welfare benefit who are not getting enough money. Those benefits are too low. The stresses on those families are too high. We know, for example, that Māori and Pacifica are highly represented in the numbers of poverty based on population. Inevitably, we are seeing that I think Māori Pacifica women, mothers are bearing the brunt of poverty in New Zealand, and more needs to be done to ensure that they can live good lives.
Thank you, Jenny. So I'm going to have to wrap up here, but before I do, I'd just like to ask if there's anything you'd like to add.
Well, I suppose we'd like to add that we're really pleased that we have the Child Poverty Reduction Act. We're really pleased that the government has acted on that. And, you know, they made that a priority as part of one of the first things they did when they came into government. And that's a huge step forward. And the fact that that bill, before it became an act, was supported, had cross-party support in Parliament, just goes to show that child poverty in New Zealand is a hugely important issue to everybody. And what we all want to see is a New Zealand where all children can flourish. And to see that and to know that's going on is really, really important. So we're really happy with that. We're really pleased by the government's families package. We're really pleased that they're setting targets to reduce child poverty. But what we really, really want to see next, what we're missing is those next steps. What we want to see is what they're going to be doing for those families on the lowest of incomes, because we really want to see benefit incomes improved and urgently.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
That was Jenny Cartwright of Child Poverty Action Group speaking to Sam earlier this morning. I'd just like to quickly apologise for the audio issues we had before. We had a small mishap with the microphone. Kōsika pereza hou, whakaronga ana koe ki te Waia Marunga, 95BFM. Whakapā mai, if you want to share your thoughts with us, tukapā tui mai, you can text us on 5395, that's 5395, or Waia mai. Give us a call in the studio on 3093879. That's 309-3879. We'll be back briefly after a little break.
Everything is completely terrible and f***ed. Everything that is, except for Whammy Bar, Wine Cellar, and 95BFM's quite good joint Christmas blowout. With NT Honey, Elegant World, Leaping Tiger, The Golden Geese, Polly Hill, Native Bush, Dick Move, Scarlet, Samuel Harmony, Sulfate, Nothing But Whole, and Shoddy. Whammy Bar, Wine Cellar, and 95BFM present Christmas 2019, December 21st at Whammy Wine Cellar and Backroom. $10 on the door, or $5 if you bring a can for the Auckland City Mission. Thanks to Nando's.
Glenn, what are you doing? You've been in there since 1 o'clock.
Mum, get out.
What are you... Oh my God, Glenn, you're completely soaked in gin.
Mum, it's just music.
God, you're dripping eclectic tunes and handpicked vinyl everywhere. Do you even know what genres you've been trying?
Mum, it's genre free.
Sweet Jesus, come on, into the shower. You're sweating music everywhere.
The Tuesday 1-4 show with Jen. 3 hours of genre-free musical exploration for your Tuesday afternoon, right here on 95BFM. Sit back, open your ears, and let it all soak in.
You've tasted a snarler, you've snacked on a sizzler or two, but have you ever had a growler? Spot on. The Growlers are coming down under and we're giving you the chance to win tickets. So just stay tuned to 95BFM all this week and make sure you've got a B-card. 95BFM presents The Growlers, Sunday, January 19th at the Power Station. Get your tickets now from AAA Ticketing.
Dark libations to the brain.
Hey, so next up we're going to have Katie Day with the song Fake Health. It's a favourite of mine, Anand.
You're tuned into 95BFM.
I'm 사랑이 말이에 오랑이 누이에 두이 혼에 오 밥을 두는 그의 타카토네 어때 타여에 아피네 이아 타도 티헤 마을이 오라.
This is the Green Desk on 95 BFM.
It sure is. Earlier this year on Green Desk, Mitchell Fuller spoke to Hugh Wilson from the Hinawai Reserve. In July this year, there was a film made about the reserve and about Hugh Wilson, the manager.
So here we are on Hinawai Reserve. We're in the southeast corner of Banks Peninsula, which is on the east coast of the South Island, jutting out into the Pacific. So Hinawai Reserve, it's a result of the Morris White Native Forest Trust. We look after 1,500 hectares. It's quite a big area, several catchments. The whole idea was to make it possible for nature to speed up the regeneration of the native forest and restore the native biodiversity as much as is possible, because we've lost some things altogether. Conservation was our first goal, to restore the biodiversity on which we're all completely dependent. We sometimes forget that. Some people say, well, why are you restoring the forest? In a way, saying why are you doing it is like saying, why should you love your mother? That's what a sort of parallel. We're totally, totally dependent on vegetation and the wildlife it supports for our own lives. We wouldn't be here if it wasn't for plants and vegetation and animals and birds and so on. I think it was in about October 1987, we wrote an article for the local newspaper, which is called the Akaroa Mail. I just thought we'd let the community know what we were doing here. It was interesting because we wrote this article, and then a few weeks later we got this amazing response from one of the farmers. I can read you that article if you like. So, it was a much longer article than this, but I said in the article, my secret...
That was a clip from the Fools and Dreamers films made by Happen Films, which you can find on YouTube. Given that this was such a success story, we thought we would revisit our story from earlier this year. Mitchell and Hugh discussed the carbon credit system available at Hinawai, which has become increasingly popular with large businesses, allowing them to offset unavoidable greenhouse gas emissions. The system has allowed the reserve to expand and encompass a significant area on the peninsula, which has rejuvenated naturally without planting and minimal pest control. Mitchell begins by asking Hugh a little bit about the history of the reserve and how it's arrived at where it's at today.
It's a big nature reserve on the southeast corner of Banks Peninsula, and it began in 1987, although the fund that helped purchase it, or that largely purchased it, was set up about 10 years before that, 1977, and that was set up by a Christchurch businessman called Morris White. And I'm a botanist while I was doing a botanical survey of Banks Peninsula, itching to buy some land for conservation purposes. I saw how much was still here just waiting to recover, basically.
Cool. So just with that, so it started off as something quite small, right? And now it's expanded to include a few stations and things like that.
It started off quite small. It was 109 hectares was the first block we bought in 1987.
So what are you up to now?
We're now up to, well, we look after 1,500 hectares, but Hinawai itself is 1,250 hectares, roughly. And then we look after an adjacent reserve for the Native Forest Restoration Trust, which is an Auckland-based, but nationwide conservation organisation.
Awesome. So how much is that? Is it all native bush, is it?
It's not all native bush. It's all regenerating into native bush. It was basically farmed country. About 4% of our whole area is old growth forest, mostly red beech, with some big podocarps scattered about as well. But most of Banks Peninsula was cleared by both Māori and Pākehā settlement.
For that, I've seen now that you can... Is it both businesses and individuals that can invest in it to purchase carbon credits to offset?
Well, we sell carbon credits through organisations, sort of, I suppose, they're sort of like brokers. The ones we're working through are Enviromark Solutions, based at Landcare in Christchurch, and also Permanent Forest New Zealand Limited, which is the Beltons, Mark and Ollie Belton.
So, say, for example, I could purchase some carbon credits. How much would it take to offset my personal carbon footprint?
Well, there are some interesting figures. This is from Enviromark Solutions. 1 hectare of Hinawai's regenerating forest is measured at fixing 10 tonnes of carbon dioxide a year, which is equivalent, I think I'm getting these figures right, it's equivalent to an average Auckland car driver 5 times per year. Does that make sense? An annual car driving.
I could cover myself for 5 years pretty much with a hectare.
Yes, you could. Yes, that's how it works out. Yeah. Although even better would be if you stopped driving your car altogether.
So how much would that cost?
Well, it's interesting because the carbon, it's an international thing, of course, with an international agreement. And the carbon prices are rising as people think begin to wake up to what's happening. So at the moment, the carbon per tonne, which is one unit, is at about $25.
So I've seen some pretty big businesses of like Kathmandu and things like that have started investing into it. Do you think that this is just going to act as a catalyst so they can sort of continue to keep doing what they're doing and then sort of just keep paying rather than
exactly
preventing it?
And that's why when it was first suggested that we register for carbon sequestration credits, that's exactly what I asked. I said, oh, well, does it mean that we're just going to shelve people's consciences and they just go on as usual?
Yeah.
So that is the big question. It is more complicated than that, and in the end we agreed to do it. It's partly because, the businesses are, I think, a lot of them are genuinely aiming for lowering their carbon footprint and even aiming for carbon zero, and they're doing it in all sorts of ways. And buying carbon credits is just one of them. And the other thing is it's a huge push for not just for sequestering carbon, but for allowing marginal hill country New Zealand to regenerate back into native forest. It's a huge financial push. I mean, farmers who have just been kept fighting gorse forever just realise now that they could leave it alone, let native forest regenerate there and actually gain income from it. So that's an amazing change.
So with that native bush, how much, like, what would make up the native bush? How much of a percent of natives would it have to be considered native bush?
There's very strict criteria. Basically, it has to be a certain proportion. I can't give the exact figure. If it was just gorse-covered hillside and grazing was taken out, animals were taken out and other animals controlled, and this regeneration of native bush sped up because of that, by the time that a certain proportion of the final canopy native trees are showing through the gorse, that's when you can start claiming carbon credits on it. But it's very carefully monitored and measured.
And just with that, so if I was to purchase some carbon credits, right, and then so you plant sort of saplings, would the...
No, the whole point is you don't plant saplings. The whole push, Hinawai's whole philosophy is minimum interference management. It's amazing how people think that the only way we're going to get native bush back is to plant it. Nature's been doing it for millions of years, and she's the expert, and we just fiddle at the edges. So planting is not the answer. And that's a big...
So it's all naturally spread.
Well, that's what the Hinawai philosophy is. Of course, the other extreme of that is that people are saying we'll plant Pinus radiata, an exotic softwood timber tree, and sequester carbon that way. And it's there's some merit in that if it's being used for timber, because while it's growing, it's sequestering carbon. But to plant Pinus radiata just for carbon sequestration is just replacing one idiotic folly with another.
So it's naturally regenerating. So if I purchased a hectare,
actually purchase a hectare. I mean, your hectare wouldn't be yours.
Yeah, of course. But with that, so would there be a lag period between me putting money in and then the actual sequestration of carbon to cover my carbon footprint?
Well, not in our case, because in our case, we use all our carbon credit money, or virtually all of it, for added land purchases.
Okay.
So the land we've got already, 1,250 hectares plus roughly 250 hectares from the other reserve next to us, which the Native Forest Restoration claim credits for, that's all busy sequestering carbon now, and the native bush is just booming away. Most of Hinawai now is native bush at some stage or other.
With that, obviously because it's regenerating naturally, has there been a rejuvenation of native species and native birds?
Oh, yes, quite significant. I'd almost say spectacular in some cases. And that's with actually very little predator control, because our biggest problem here is rats. As everywhere, the problem is rats. And if you just take out the stoats and the ferrets and the cats, the risk and almost certain consequences that you increase the rat population. So we don't actually target, that seems like counter common sense to many people, but we don't target those bigger predators except down by the sea, where we protect, help the community, does it to protect the penguins.
Of course, yeah.
Another issue. But up the valleys here, no, we don't take out those predators. But despite all that, with the increasingly good habitat, the birds are thriving, the birds that are still here. I mean, we wouldn't be able to have kākāriki or kōkako or tieke or anything like that. But the birds that are here, including some that seem so vulnerable, like riflemen and kereru and bellbirds galore, brown creeper, which is a South Island endemic, it's Stewart Island, South Island endemic, they're just thriving. They're in big numbers.
That's amazing. Just with that, that's obviously, so Hennywise operating as our little carbon sink in New Zealand. Do you have any figures on how much carbon is actually being absorbed or sequestered by Hennywise currently?
I couldn't give you those figures off the top of my head.
That's right.
But the whole of Hinawai is not actually mapped for carbon. The whole of Hinawai is mapped for carbon sequestration, but some of it hasn't crossed the threshold yet.
Okay.
We were talking about before. So I think it's something like about, it's probably only about a third to a half of Hinawai that's actually being registered for carbon. It's all sequestering carbon because it's all just steadily progressing as a natural succession into native bush, but it hasn't crossed a threshold.
Okay.
Being paid for carbon credits.
So what do you think? What do you want to see in the future for Hinawai? Do you guys have more land that can be purchased and expansion?
Yeah, we don't want to grow big just for the sake of growing big, but there's about four blocks of land we're particularly interested in adding for conservation reasons and also for management reasons. It just makes the management simpler. So there's conservation pluses and management simplicity. But also we extend from the subalpine summits here on the southeast Banks Peninsula, but almost to sea level, but we don't go to the sea. And we'd love to have a whole representative slice of Akaroa Ecological District, more land, and that's what the carbon credit money is going to.
What do you think can be learned from the Hinawai experience?
Well, the biggest thing that can be learned is that the number one enemy for pastoral farming is often cited as gorse, and it is an appalling weed for pastoral farming. But once it's entrenched in the landscape, it's just uneconomic. It doesn't make economic or conservation sense to try and keep fighting it. And it's very nice to know that, left alone, gorse and a few other weeds act as a nurse canopy temporarily, get completely swamped by native forest regeneration under the right management regimes, and you get native forest and carbon sequestration, the biggest lesson. And people come here, even the farmers around us who were so sceptical at first. I don't think there's a single farmer around us now who's not completely behind us, which is a remarkable thing, really.
That was The Green Desk on 95 BFM. Tihe Modi Ora.
It was indeed The Green Desk. That was Mitchell Fuller speaking to Hugh Wilson of the Hinawai Reserve earlier this year. We'll be right back after a song by Sufjan Stevens entitled Casimir Pulaski Day.
Goldenrod and the 4-H stone, the things I brought you when I found out you had cancer off the bone. Your father cried on the telephone, and he drove his car into the Navy Yard just to prove that he was sorry. In the morning, shade, when the light pressed up against your shoulder blade, I could see what you were reading. All the glory that the Lord has made, and the complications you could do without, when I kissed you on the mouth. Tuesday night at the Bible study, we lift our hands and pray over your body, but nothing ever happens. I remember at Michael's house in the living room when you kissed my neck and I almost touched your blouse. Stairs when your father found out what we did that night, and you told me you were scared. All the glory when you ran outside with your shirt tucked in and your shoes untied, and you told me not to follow you. Thank you.
Sunday night, when I clean the house, I find the card where you wrote it out, with the pictures of your mother. On the floor at the great divide, with my shirt tucked in and my shoes untied, I am crying in the bathroom. In the morning when you finally go, and the nurse runs in with her head hung low, and the cardinal hits the window. In the morning, in the winter shade, on the 1st of March, on the holiday, I thought I saw you breathing. All the glory that the Lord has made, and the complications when I see his face, in the morning, in the window. All the glory when he took our place, but he took my shoulders and he shook my face, and he takes, and he takes, and he takes.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Koska pereza ho e whakaronga ana koe ki te Wire Marunga 95BFM. That was Sufjan Stevens. Whakapa mai, if you want to share your thoughts with us, tukapatui mai, you can send us a text on Rima Toru Iwa Rima, that's 5395, or Wire Mai, give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa, Toru Waru Fitu Iwa, that's 309-3879. We'll dive into our final piece for you today. Last week saw the launch of He Taonga I Te Tamariti, Every Child a Taonga, the Early Learning Action Plan for 2019 to 2029. It's a foundational plan from the coalition government to create a, quote, long-lasting change or long-lasting changes to early learning. Minister Chris Hipkins says the action plan sets out the priorities agreed with the sector and the public after the most extensive consultation process in the history of early learning in New Zealand, and sets out that early learning will be one of the government's top education priorities going into 2020. Accordingly, the government will be working starting next year and over the next 4 years, assuming they get in, to advance the actions in the plan, including incentivising for 100% and regulating for 80% of qualified teachers in teacher-led centres, then regulation for 100% longer term, in the long term. Improving the consistency and levels of teachers' salaries and conditions. The government will also advance work on the development of an early learning teacher supply strategy, a more active management approach to the network so all children have access to high-quality learning. Improving adult-to-child ratios for children under 2 years from 1 to 5 to 1 to 4 and from 1 to 10 to 1 to 5 for 2-year-olds, as funding allows. Making sure that children in underserved communities have access to high quality services that support their identity, culture, and language. Some of the plan's objectives will be progressed in the Education and Training Bill, which Hipkins introduced to Parliament this week. The bill changes licensing arrangements to ensure a more equitable and sustainable network. It also proposes increased monitoring to improve quality and safeguards for children in home-based early learning services, according to the minister. He also confirmed the government has adopted a new early learning participation intensity measure, showing that more children participated in early learning at 3 and 4 years of age for 20 hours or more per week in 2019. I talked to Erin Maloney of Tiny Nation Early Learning about the release of He Taonga Te Tamaiti, but started by asking her to introduce what Tiny Nation is.
We're a new home-based early learning provider that have kick-started in Hawke's Bay with a view to roll out more nationally in the future. We're focused on bringing the quality back into home-based early learning and making sure that the work we do is really strongly aligned with the government's plan for early learning going forward, and very collaborative, working alongside educators and families. So we work only with trained and qualified educators and teachers, which is a key point of difference for us.
Right. So when you discuss home-based early learning, what does that mean?
So basically, when you look at early childhood education as a broad spectrum in New Zealand, there's different service types. The most mainstream or popular choice is centre-based provision, and that's the larger group-based care model. Then you've obviously got the kindergartens, you've got home-based, which is care that is delivered from an educator's home or from the home of a family if they choose to have a nanny.
Right.
And the difference between home-based and centre-based largely is that home-based is a small group care option, which means that children in home-based are one of only four children, versus centre-based care models where you can be one of up to 150 children.
With the launch last week of the Early Learning Action Plan, what does that mean for what comes out of the education provided by home-based learning?
So what the home-based sector has been through in the last year, alongside the Early Learning Strategic Plan that's been kind of canvassed and consulted on, is a home-based review. And so that's formed a part of the wider action plan. And there are references to home-based in the action plan, but there has been a more specific, I guess, review of home-based and consultation process around that, which has seen the introduction of minimum qualifications for educators is, I guess, probably the biggest change. And it's also seen the introduction of different policy around regulations and changes to the way that we support educators to deliver home-based early learning.
The findings from the review of home-based learning have fed into this latest release. Could you give the listeners a bit of a brief overview of what the latest release is?
Sure. So the latest release is based on strategic intent for the whole of the early learning sector in New Zealand. So that incorporates all of the different service types that are operating and delivering education and care for our under fives. The key, I guess, takeaways from the action plan that's just been released is that it is an action plan and it is an intention set by government around changes that they're looking to make to the early learning sector over the next 10 years. And some of the key changes that have come out of that is a focus on looking at ratios, which we were really excited about as a home-based early learning provider, because currently we know what the research says around how children benefit from small groups, attachment relationships with their caregivers and with their educators, and there's a movement towards that happening more in centre-based environments too, which we'll see ratios go from one adult to 10 children that are two down to one adult to five children, two-year-old children. So there is a definite move towards, I guess, wanting to increase the quality of care provision. The ratios is one aspect of it. And then there are other movements, obviously, towards recognising teachers more. And you've probably seen a lot happening in the media as of late from the whole sector in terms of pay parity for teachers and wanting to, I guess, recognise the very important work that early childhood educators are doing out there, not just in kindergartens who have their own agreement, but in across all care provisions, recognising that and making sure that the salaries reflect that.
Is there anything that you or Tiny Nation would have liked to have seen that perhaps wasn't included in the action plan going forward, or do you think it was a pretty comprehensive plan for all moulds of early childhood education?
I think it's a great starting point. To be honest, I think there's still a lot of work to do in consultation with the sector around how the action plan is actually rolled out, and I think that's what you would probably hear from a lot of different providers, that it definitely sets a tone around what the expectations are in terms of the future of early learning and what the aspirations are. There are some pretty big aspirations there in terms of qualifications, a big move from I guess going from untrained teachers into qualified teachers on the floor, and that expectation that eventually 100% teachers in early learning will be qualified. What I think now needs to happen is there needs to be some really clear measures around how that's going to happen, because we're currently working through a bit of a workforce shortage where we've got, a big issue happening in the sector around services actually being able to recruit for those qualified teachers because there just aren't enough of them. So there needs to be, I guess, more of a measure around how we achieve some of these things. And also I think what's really missing is some timeframes and some real accountabilities around the how we're going to actually work towards that, across what time frame, how it's actually going to be funded, because a lot of the measures that are being suggested or that are being mooted as action points will require investment. Who's making that investment? How's that going to filter through to service providers to be able to actually support the higher quality learning outcomes for children? So there's still a lot of the how, I think, that hasn't been articulated that needs to be articulated. It's very much an intention, and that's probably where it's been left at this point.
More on that how, what timeframes would you like to see kind of placed on some of the goals, such as the qualifications, some of the pay grade changes and some of the ratio changes? And what do you think are realistic timeframes for us and the early childhood sector to be looking at for implementing these changes?
Well, I think the Ministry have set a goal around, obviously, it being a 10-year action plan, and they obviously see some of the actions. There's 25 actions that they've articulated as a part of this plan, and they've gone some way, I suppose, to prioritise what that would look like across the board in terms of what would see action first versus what would see action a bit later on in the piece. I think what requires the most urgent attention is obviously looking at pay parity for teachers. I think as soon as that is addressed in a meaningful way, what we'll see is a change to the way that we acknowledge and value teachers in the sector, and hopefully a surge in new teachers wanting to come in and train, and also, I guess, teachers being retained by their services and not looking to go elsewhere, and especially not looking to leave the sector. I think if we can address that as a priority in the first instance, that will go a long way to actually supporting the government to achieve the other action plans that they've identified.
And taking a few steps back, how do you think we've kind of arrived at this point where this is the steps that we need to take forward? Like, what has contributed to these being the 25 suggestions that are being made for the next 10 years and the kind of future of early childhood education?
So this time last year, the government released their strategic plan, which was basically the consultation plan, and the actions that they've identified as a part of the action plan that's just been released have come from a year of consultation with the sector. This has been a part of the wider education conversation that's taken place. It's rolled out with all of the different education providers across the whole education sector. So I'm talking early learning, primary, secondary and tertiary, all very much included as a part of that wider education conversation. So there has been an intent to connect with and collaborate with the sector, which has been great to see. And that's been a big part of the release of the action plan, and the consultation that they've taken from that has informed the decisions that they've made.
That was Erin Maloney of Tiny Nation Early Learning speaking on He Taonga Te Tamaiti. We'll be back after a little break to wrap up the show.
Way up in glorious Waitangi, Bay of Islands Music Festival is calling. With Toots and the Maytals, Shaggy, She-Head, Wolf Mother, Lady Six and so much more. If you want to win tickets to this fabulous festival and you've got a B-card, just listen to BFM Breakfast all this week. Bay of Islands Music Festival Waitangi, January 25th and 26th. Tickets from eventfinder.co.nz.
Compared to your average meat-based quarter pounder, every Lord of the Fries burger saves over 3 kilograms of equivalent CO2 greenhouse gas emissions and a whopping 217 litres of water use.
Lord of the Fries are saving the world bite by bite. Now you can join their plant-based ethical fast food movement. LOTFNZ are equity crowdfunding with PledgeMe.
Invest in the company and help the world get greener and cleaner. Plus, score some juicy rewards.
Grab your own bite of Lord of the Fries New Zealand. Go to lordofthefries.co.nz.
Cocktail Corner. It's not a corner in your traditional sense. It doesn't take up any physical space. It certainly doesn't have any sharp edges. No, Cocktail Corner is an emotional space, a spiritual area, a reflection of a painting of a wish to wander through life's delicious moments. Cocktail Corner, 5:30 every Thursday, only on 95 BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. Thanks to the wonderful people of K Road. The best food, coffee and conversation. Make yourself feel at home.
Indeed. So I've just got time for one little last track from soccer practice. This is Lowdown, and then we'll get to thank everyone and tune in. If you do have any last minute thoughts about any of the pieces you've heard today, yeah, don't get afraid to get in touch. We've had a few texts in so far, and we may have a little chance right at the end to discuss them as the show kind of closes out.
Yeah.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Kua o te katoa te hotaka mo tine rā. That was The Wire for Ratu Tuesday, the 10th of December, haka here. Thank you all for tuning in and sending us your words of wisdom and feedback. A big thank you to all of those who spoke to us today, Aaron Maloney, Jenny Cartwright and Hugh Wilson. And as always, a big thank you to the station and you, the listener. Mā te wā, that's it from us for now, but be sure to tune in next week for the highlights of The Wire. And keep tuned across the rest of the week as well for the rest of the wonderful wires that are brought to you. We'll leave you with some more music for your afternoon and your listening pleasures with Jin, who is indeed here for the rest of this summery afternoon. You'd be a fool to tune out now. You're listening to 95BFM. And in the break between the shows, this is Salad Boys with This Issue.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.